Welcome, everybody. This is the Onc Live hosted Ask the Expert. The title of the talk is Evolving Imaging Strategies in Glioma. I'm Mike Veronese. I'm an associate professor in neuroradiology at the University of Wisconsin. I'm also the director of neuro-oncological imaging.
My name is Kate Neville. I'm a neuro-oncologist. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology, and I practice at Indiana University. What are the main limitations you face when relying on conventional and advanced MRI for evaluation of your patients who have glioma, whether that's, you know, response assessment, diagnosis, or just monitoring their disease? Scheduling perfusion is the best, but it's also imperfect. With perfusion, is there any benefits to longitudinal assessment to check for changes in the amount of perfusion change seen?
I mean, there certainly is. I think if you have it as part of your routine brain tumor protocol, I think that's pretty easy to do. If it's not part of the routine protocol, though, then, you know, calling the patient back every time. If it's not well integrated into the normal scan, then it could take longer scan times, things like that. So then you're starting to deal with patient discomfort, patient motion issues, things like that. So we actually have integrated it just into our regular brain tumor protocol. So we do it at all phases of the management.
Yeah. Mike, so I think one of the questions, which I think is an interesting question, and I know you and I have debated, I can think of one scenario where you and I have debated, is there any value in the change of perfusion over time? You know, we tend to think of it like as a binary, you know, perfusion is positive or negative. But is there, you know, we've certainly had cases where it's technically negative, but it's increasing over time. And we've debated the significance of that. Just off the top of my head, I'm not sure that I can think of an individual where that's happened and then it was a harbinger for tumor progression. But I don't know, what's your experience been?
Yeah, I think in general, the way DSC kind of works visually for me is if I have contrast enhancement that's increasing, usually my perfusion is going to increase as well. I would say that that there are certain circumstances where you do see perfusion elevation in the non-enhancing part of the tumor, and I think that's a bad prognostic component. I think that thing's converting quickly would be an example. So I do look for that. I would say, though, that in general, I personally feel more comfortable if I have that ratio that I'm using, because you can have even between this one, the same patient, a previous and a subsequent exam, you have to have an internal control so that the contralateral white matter will help. So if you have that as a comparison, that hopefully shouldn't change too much between patients. So that ratio is helpful for also following to see if we really are seeing increasing signal over time. If we don't see the signal increasing, though, then, you know, that doesn't necessarily, unfortunately, mean that always that you don't have increasing tumor, because, right, because perfusion is a measure of neovascularity. And so you can have tumors that are changing and converting, but they're not necessarily, for whatever reason or other, especially in the setting and in the presence of treatment, undergoing neovascularity, right? So the bevacizumab, for example, reverses that neovascularity component. So if I see abnormal perfusion in a patient with BEV, then I grow pretty concerned, because that means that treatment might be wearing off.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in terms of the discussion questions on the slide, a lot of people answered something to the effect of, you know, the main limitations are determining whether somebody has true progression or whether their imaging changes are representative of tumor progression or pseudoprogression. And several of you mentioned additional imaging, advanced imaging modalities that you use at your institution. Sounds like most of you use perfusion, which I would say is pretty standard in most neuro-oncology practices, as Mike mentioned, but some of you are using spectroscopy and FDG PET. Somebody mentioned that they often pull up, you know, how do you address these limitations? A lot of you answered along the lines of, you know, close monitoring and clinical judgment. You know, we all, I think most of us, you know, do that. We'll follow this and repeat a scan in, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something closer than what we, sooner than what we would typically. And somebody else mentioned, you know, pulling up the radiation plan and seeing how that overlies with the imaging change that you're seeing.
Yeah, I like the comment about trying to get any and every modality that I can, spectroscopy, perfusion, DSC. I like that one.
Yeah.
The next slide goes over the latest RANO-EANO guidelines for immunoacid PET in glioma imaging. When's it recommended? Just like the 2016 version, pretty much all phases. But this one actually kind of focuses on the three areas in the post-surgical pre-radiation therapy. It's really hard to get patients if they come into the ER and they're not that well. A lot of patients need to go to surgery, so it's really hard to get that PET. If you can get it before surgery, that's great, but it's really easier and more feasible from a planning standpoint to be able to get that PET after surgery and before the start of radiation therapy. Then you can get in a reasonable fashion one after the radiation therapy. And then the third area that's kind of really highlighted in this review is that question of trying to distinguish between treatment change and tumor relapse. We're still working on this, right? We're still always trying to figure out which of the advanced imaging, whether PET or MRI, we can use to help us. This was just an example of a really large meta-analysis that was done in differentiating a progression from pseudo-progression. And basically, it's kind of like all the papers that have been published on the topic throughout the literature, which is what's showing here in terms of number of studies for each of these different PET or MRI modalities, MRI, SPECTs, imaging, and FDG. And this is positron emission tomography. This isn't spectroscopy. So these are kind of the ones that were given the lower scores. This is kind of the Sucre score that's given here is a relative value. So it's not an absolute value. So, you know, it doesn't say by how much better was, for instance, you know, methionine relative to, like, say, RCPV perfusion. But it's a general ranking of how each study that was published found the particular either imaging modality or PET radio tracer, how well they found it to be. FET, methionine, and DOPA, 18F DOPA, all got pretty good scores. APT-SUS was another one that got a high score, but it's got a pretty low publication number. So we obviously need to get more publications in those areas, but it's an interesting study that was done. When do we think that we should try to implement these or utilize these, right? You can't do PET on everybody. It just would be too logistically difficult. It would overrun the clinical services. These PET MRs and PET CTs, they take a little bit of time. So we obviously don't want to do them on everybody, but I think I would just go back to that RANO criteria and use it in those strategic times after surgery, before radiation, after radiation to get your baseline. You know, so you've done your chemo radiation, now you get your baseline. And then as you're following that patient, when you start to see increasing enhancement or some other concern, that's when you can bring that emerging modality, including PET, into the situation. And then how do you integrate findings? Someone made a comment earlier about all of the ones they can get a hold of, and I think that's actually a fantastic answer. It's kind of like a toolkit. If you have more tools in your toolkit, you're going to have a better looking product at the end. And if they're not pointing in the same direction, yeah, then that can create problems. It has for us because the imaging's not perfect. So, but in general, I would like to try to get more if I can. And then there's, over time, you'll build your trust for one versus the other. All right, we'll go into the clinical scenarios. What do you think, Kate?
Sounds good. So I'm just going to run through a few clinical scenarios. These are patients who I take care of. And so these are real world examples of how we've used advanced imaging to help assist the management of patients. So for this first case, this is a person in their 20s with a pediatric WHO grade 4 glioma, IDH wild type, MGMT unmethylated with those other mutations as listed. This individual underwent a subtotal resection. You can see T1 post-contrast MRI, axial view, that there's a pretty large, almost kind of cystic appearing, enhancing lesion in the right kind of frontotemporal region. And then post-op, this is what this individual was left with, was a subtotal resection, can see a little bit of enhancement around the resection cavity, concerning for some residual enhancing tumor. This individual proceeded with standard of care therapy for glioblastoma. So standard radiation with temozolomide concurrent and planned for adjuvant temozolomide. So the images on the bottom left are just kind of reminder reference images. This is what this individual's scan looked like before surgery. This was their post-op imaging, kind of pre-radiation scan. And then on the first post-radiation brain MRI, there's this new enhancing, kind of heterogeneously enhancing lesion. And our perfusion characteristics, the mean RCBV was in a ratio 4:1, so elevated in a range consistent or concerning for tumor recurrence. This is this individual's first post-radiation brain MRI. So I will pose the question of, like, you know, this is not an unusual scenario necessarily. This is, you know, something that we've all kind of seen things along this line. So what do you do in this scenario? And if you had this patient in your practice, how would you handle it? Would you interpret this as tumor progression and change therapy for this individual on this first post-radiation scan in someone who has an MGMT unmethylated high-grade glioma with a new enhancing lesion and elevated perfusion? Would you say it's too early and we're going to repeat a scan and continue the course? Or would you use some other type of advanced imaging? So as people are thinking about that and answers are coming in, I will share that what we did, obviously, since we're talking about advanced imaging in this talk, is that we are fortunate that we have FET PET capability. And so we obtained FET PET on this individual. So again, this is the first, this image here on the left is the first post-radiation brain MRI showing this new lesion with elevated perfusion. About 6 weeks after this scan, we got a new set of imaging, MRI perfusion plus FET PET in a kind of single scan day for this individual. This lesion was actually a little bit worse appearing on T1 post-contrast. You can kind of, it's hard to compare because these images aren't quite next to each other and size a little differently, but this was larger. It was still hyperperfusing, but the FET PET values were actually below what we call below our institutional threshold for being tumor, so more consistent with treatment-related change. So in light of that, having a growing or enlarging lesion at this kind of six-week mark, still hyperperfusing, but FET PET is reassuring, that is a conundrum when our, as Mike was sharing, you know, talking about earlier, when our imaging doesn't all agree in terms of the underlying etiology of the lesion. So we continued, so this person started, I didn't say this, but started adjuvant Temodar, and we continued this individual's adjuvant Temodar. And then this individual had a second FET PET about 6 weeks later from the first FET PET. And at this point, you can see that the enhancement is decreased, the RCBV is reduced, and the FET PET threshold is still below threshold, so still consistent with treatment-related change. And for this individual, this is, you know, their scan from that first post-radiation brain MRI, and then 3 years later, still, they're eventually this lesion ultimately just had resolution of that lesion and has had stable scans since then. So the take-home point from this is that, you know, early on, FET PET can help accurately diagnose or distinguish between treatment-related changes and tumor progression, in the setting of worsening MRI and MRI perfusion, particularly in patients that fall into this, you know, it was early days, so absolutely pseudoprogression clinically made sense, but also this patient had an MGMT unmethylated tumor and had elevated perfusion, so was concerning for possible tumor progression also. This imaging was helpful for in discussions with this patient too, and providing some additional level of reassurance or hopefulness that this was pseudoprogression. So in our second clinical case, this is an individual in their 40s who had a glioblastoma, also MGMT unmethylated. This individual underwent a standard of care protocol with radiation and concurrent temozolomide. This is this individual's post-op MRI. I'm not sure how well this is projecting, but you can see the craniotomy site and a very small resection cavity with a little bit of enhancement around the resection cavity. This first post-radiation brain MRI is what's demonstrated on the right. You can see that there's increased enhancement. There's some nodularity to it, especially at the more anterior border, and increasing in flare signal abnormality. But RCBV was not elevated above background. And again, this is this person's first scan. I've seen several responses from that last case that, even if the first scan is concerning, you just keep going with the standard of care and follow. And so that's what we did in this scenario, but we did plan for an FET PET, again, because we have FET PET, we're fortunate enough to have FET PET readily available at our institution. So this individual started adjuvant temozolomide and Tumor Treating Fields after that first post-radiation MRI. This individual underwent an FET PET MRI 2 months after their initial post-radiation scan. So this is 2 months after their initial post-radiation scan. This lesion is yet again a little bit bigger, not significantly so, but a little, this enhancement is a little bit larger, covering a larger area than it was on that first post-radiation scan. The flare signal is a little bit worse. RCBV is still not elevated above background, but the FET PET was above our institutional threshold, meeting criteria for being consistent with tumor progression. So again, we have some discordance. This lesion was a little bit worse on kind of our standard imaging, but not a lot worse. So, after a lot of discussion with this patient, decided let's give it a few more cycles of the Temodar. We'll start looking into potential clinical trial opportunities while we're doing that, and repeat another FET PET. And at the time point of the repeat FET PET, you can see this is clearly, the T1 post contrast shows this is clearly worse. The flare signal is significantly worse. Now the RCBV is elevated above background, meeting criteria for tumor, and the FET PET is also still consistent with this being tumor. This individual was planned to enroll in a clinical trial and underwent a pre-surgical MRI that showed this lesion just was continuing to worsen. This was not an FET PET. It was a MRI brain with perfusion. And this individual underwent repeat resection and the PET as part of the clinical trial, and that pathology was all a tumor. How do you all use MRI perfusion, because that's the most common thing that we tend to use in our imaging assessments? How much weight do you put in the MRI perfusion in the early stage after radiation? Within the first, let's say 12 weeks after radiation, how much weight do you put into the perfusion when there's a lesion that's appearing worse on T1 post contrast? Does that influence your treatment decisions in that first kind of early stages, first couple months after radiation? Or do you kind of take in that data point and continue on with kind of whatever plan you had in place for that patient initially?
Yeah, so there's different time points at which folks start to use MR perfusion, start to get a little bit more or less concerned
Sounds like in early stages, put less weight on MR perfusion, early stages after radiation than later on, which I think is pretty typical. So would you consider adding metabolic imaging like amino acid PET in these types of situations to distinguish between active tumor and treatment-related changes or edema target volume estimates for surgical planning in patients who might be undergoing a repeat resection?
Problem solving at certain points, and it can be too early after radiation therapy. You can even have, you can certainly have elevated RCBV. You can have even elevated PET in the earlier stages of radiation. I think some of it's got to be based on how they're doing clinically, but kind of putting the whole clinical picture together is still going to be very important. It's just, you just can't deny that.
What emerging neuroimaging strategies or technologies are you most excited about?
I don't like a single imaging of anything. I really like a baseline if I can get it, and then I get a follow-up. So that also applies to PET as well.
Yeah, and Mike and I have shared, several patients who obviously these cases that I shared today had serial PET imaging, FET PET. And I've had many patients who've had serial FET PETs over the course of 2 years, every 3 months get an FET PET. These people who have fluctuating enhancing lesions that we've been following. And it's been very helpful on several of these patients and really, I think, has avoided, in my opinion, unnecessary overtreatment of people for imaging changes that ultimately end up being treatment-related changes if you're patient enough. And FET PET has, I think, enabled me to feel more comfortable with being patient enough with some of these fluctuating imaging changes that look concerning, even sometimes on perfusion.
There are certainly times when the PET actually, was challenging for us. And obviously, we always want to try to bring the patient and the treating physician's the right answer. And sometimes we just even with all of the available information, it's still very difficult to do that at times. So I will say PET is not perfect, even though I think it's what we can improve on.
There also were several comments as I'm scrolling through about low-grade glioma, and that definitely is an unanswered question, just anecdotally, because I have, kind of more readily access to FET PET. I've used FET PET for some of my patients with low-grade gliomas, and it's been helpful in, I would say, a few cases in identifying areas to target resection, maybe in areas of like larger flare signal abnormality, for example, identifying areas that we might be most worried about that maybe are starting to transform to higher grade tumors, kind of like that example that Mike gave earlier on about that individual who had a much larger area of FET PET abnormality than they did enhancing disease. And there was a question about, the one case that I presented, and if that individual had resection beyond the enhancing margin of the flare signal abnormality. And yes, that individual did. And yes, some of that was tumor, which seemed to correlate with the FET PET.
Yeah, there's been some pretty good studies published on that, doing biopsies outside in the non-enhancing tissue. And it's come back. If the FET is positive, then there's usually tumor there. So that's another thing. And Kate, you and I have a paper submitted on prognosis, right? So the more higher the PET activity and volume tends to portend a worse prognosis. So even if you're dealing with predominantly treatment change, for instance, regardless, the increased PET activity, at least from a prognostication standpoint, has been helpful.